Hello, and welcome to The Making of, a Nat Geo podcast. I'm your host, Stacey Wilson-Hunt, and with me today are the executive producers and co-creators of Nat Geo's global adventure reality series, Race to the Center of the Earth, Bertram Van Munster and Elise Dogonieri. Welcome to both of you. So happy to have you here. And I must say, I was looking up the date of the premiere of The Amazing Race, and we are approaching the 20-year anniversary this September. How does that feel?
It's pretty astounding that we're coming to the 20th anniversary of The Amazing Race. We honestly, when we first sold the show, we thought maybe we would get one season or two if we were lucky. So actually having 32 seasons that have aired is pretty astounding for us also.
Particularly after 9/11, because the first show aired a week after 9/11. It was a disaster.
I remember.
All the buses that had all the Amazing Race logos and everything on it in New York City, all covered with soot and stuff. It was so sad, the whole thing. It was horrendous.
I remember that. But also, I feel like the show brought such a sense of hope and expansiveness and sort of the world that lay, you know, outside of all that sadness. And I was living in New York at that time, and it felt sort of like a wonderful escape to know that there was sort of hope after such a terrible sequence of events.
There is, and the Amazing Race brings people together, brings nations together, brings millions of people together every week around the globe. So, yeah, no, it's a miracle. And 32 seasons is a bigger miracle. You know, you never know what
yes.
you get a pickup for 32 times. You don't know if you get a pickup or not.
It's essentially you and the Simpsons at this point. You're neck and neck, right?
In good company.
That's right. Well, we're here today, obviously, to speak about your newest project, which is just as ambitious, and I might say probably even more ambitious, if that's even possible, Race to the Center of the Earth. And I would love for you to talk about what inspired this iteration of the so-called global adventure race.
The inspiration actually came from us always being asked, what's next for you? Can you come up with the next amazing race? And Bertram and I have had a long relationship with National Geographic. Bertram, many more years than me. He's done many films with National Geographic, traveled the globe with them. And they actually approached us with a rough concept that a company had come to them with, but didn't know how to crack the code of doing it. So they came to us because it's our specialty, global travel, global adventure, reality competition shows. And they really tasked us with one of our biggest challenges ever to create an adventure race that would start in different points of the globe, ending in one location. And that was pretty exciting and thrilling for us to develop that idea and create what is now Race to the Center of the Earth, basically starting with four teams of three people starting in very different environments in four different areas of the globe, as far away as you can possibly imagine from each other, and doing that in a stage one and then a final stage and a final leg. But they all run together to meet at one final point for the final $1 million prize.
Wow. It's so dramatic. And Bert, tell me a little bit about, and it sounds like you have a long history with Nat Geo. Why was the network the perfect home for this show? And what are you able to do with this series that fits that Nat Geo mold?
Well, first of all, you know, we can show the beauty of the globe and the validity of travel and without destroying nature, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's the perfect home because of its background. National Geographic has been known for over 100 years doing this type of stuff, but now with modern technology, and we can go everywhere and anywhere at any time. I think it's a perfect time. And also put people a little bit their nose on how important it is that we keep the world and the globe intact.
Yes, huge priorities for everyone right now. And Bert, I've actually always wanted to ask you this. Maybe it's because I've been watching a lot of Dutch television during quarantine.
Yeah.
I'd love to know, why have so many reality formats come out of the Netherlands, which is admittedly not a huge country? But your fellow countrymen and countrywomen have created some of the most indelible formats, including Big Brother, Deal or No Deal, The Voice, Fear Factor. What is it about the Netherlands and where you come from that lends itself to these formats?
It's interesting. You know, when I was still living in Holland, we were always asking it ourselves, you know, why are we good doing documentaries? Because in those days it was documentary, documentary, documentary. Why are we so good at it? Is it because the old painters, you know, the Rembrandts and
right.
I mean, why do we like it so much and why are we good at it? I don't know. I mean, there's an original way of thinking. It's very, you know, Dutch are very individual, come up with fun ideas, very progressive thinking and intelligent thinking. So I know the people that came up with all these ideas, you know, pretty good. I mean, they're really intelligent, original thinkers. There's no question about it.
It's sort of what pasta is to Italy, reality TV is to the Netherlands.
Very beautifully put, yeah.
So, Lisa, I'd like to talk about the casting of Race to the Center of the Earth, which I think probably presented a number of challenges for the sake that the demands on these people are very intense. And from my estimation, they all appear to be almost elite athletes and have almost expert survival skills in the wilderness. So how did you maintain an openness and inclusivity, which is obviously so important in these shows? And by the way, Amazing Race broke so many boundaries with its depictions of people from different ethnic backgrounds and gay people. And that's what I've always thought of with your shows. How were you approaching this particular series? Because the casting had to be a little bit more specific, I imagine.
Yes. The casting on the show was very specific, but we did want to make it a point that people were not professional adventure racers or professional athletes, because it is so important for us that when somebody watches the show, that even though these people are doing miraculous things and their, you know, their adrenaline drives them and their disposition, who they are, drives them and their sense of adventure drives them, they are all amateur adventurers. They all have careers and jobs. We had three teachers on the show for one group. They all work together and they take children on, you know, outdoor adventures. They're a wonderful group. We had another group that were police officers in Alaska. That's their full-time job.
Those people are very funny.
They are hysterically funny. They all kind of rib on each other all the time. They've got great personalities and we just love their sense of humor and that they kind of got along all the time, even though they had some tense moments throughout the series. They poked at each other all the time and they kind of laughed at themselves and didn't take things too seriously, although fiercely competitive. Then we had a group of climbers who just regular climbers who had full-time jobs also. They're three friends out of Colorado. And then another group that was the team leader, Dave Bacon. He owns a company, and these are two people that work with him. One loves to run, one loves to ski. They all come from different backgrounds, but they have similar interests in that they have a huge sense of adventure and that they want to go into the unknown. They want to travel the world. They all love to travel the world. And this was like the most epic challenge they could ever take on. And they didn't know where they were going and they couldn't wait to find out. And wherever we dropped them into in the four corners of our round globe, they were thrilled and excited and couldn't wait every day to keep going.
The dynamic in that team was really, really incredible because it's the boss and people working for them. So that added an additional amount of spice to the whole situation.
The group dynamics are very relatable for sure.
Yeah, we want the viewer to sit at home and say, you know, okay, these are not professional athletes. They're weekend warriors. And I can see myself trying something crazy like this and fun.
And also relatable in the sense that we see them struggle. One of the women in one of the groups talks about how afraid she is of swimming. And once you see, and without spoiling it, you see what she has in front of her to do. It's hard not to completely relate to that, that terror of that. And she's very open about it, which I think makes the show feel, oh, I can see myself doing this.
That was a really interesting moment for us because she was such a strong woman and seemed like she could conquer any challenge set before her. She has a love of climbing, and then put her in the water and whole different story, whole bunch of fear and, you know, just what's under the water. You know, a lot of people feel that way. I can't see the bottom, so I don't know what's underneath my feet. And all of that stuff came back to her and even from childhood. And you see her very much struggling through it and seeing how the team, you know, tries to help work with her to get her going so they don't fall too far behind.
Yes.
They can't prepare themselves for it because they never know what's next with our shows. You never know what's next, what the next 5 minutes is going to bring.
That's right.
Can't prepare yourself. You either do it or you don't. And they did it.
Well, it's also, there's such a wonderful sense of competition among the groups themselves and the team members where you know your team members are counting on you to perform. Boy, there's no better motivation, right?
Right. You don't want to let your teammate down. Each three-person team came with their individual strengths. So maybe somebody was really good with navigation. Someone was really good, you know, with the navigator reading the maps or even, you know, driving a vehicle. And somebody else was an expert climber. So you have to cheer your team on, or somebody really good with boating and whatever. You know, we put them in so many different environments. Like the world was our oyster. The world was our roadmap. And we basically had them go through areas of mountains and streams and rivers and snowstorms and glaciers, and they just had to get through it. So everybody shined at moments and everybody failed at moments.
It's another thing to be dropped off in some place around the globe somewhere, and people said, go ahead, let's go, start the race. And then you end up in a horrendous snowstorm that you don't anticipate. You know, they can barely see 10 feet ahead of themselves. It's mentally, it's also a very, very tough race. You can't prepare yourself for something like that.
Absolutely not. And tell me what kind of gear each person is outfitted with. Are they given clothes for every climate, and are they carrying all those items with them? How does that work?
We actually ask them to pack their own bags and to prepare for all different types of weather, you know, rain, cold, heat. If there were some extreme locations that we knew were coming up that might have been, you know, the glacial areas and things like that, we did supply them with gear because you just can't, it would be too much for them to carry. They literally had to carry, you know, a giant pack on their back and kind of trudge through everything like that. So certain areas where they needed climbing gear and things like that, we didn't ask them to carry, but the clothes on their back for the everyday was what they all prepared for, sunscreen and whatever they thought they needed. You know, there was a lot of survival type pieces to this adventure race.
Bert, I know your background is in cinematography. So, you know, when I'm watching a show like this, I'm thinking, who is operating these cameras? Who are these heroes whose faces we never see, who are bringing us into the water, bringing us onto the mountains? And are they facing the same physical challenges as the contestants?
Yes. So this is where I am very proud. These guys have all worked for me for many, many years, and they know my style. We just move forward. We climb, we go, we don't stop, we're not scared. They're not just strong guys that can schlep a bunch of stuff on a mountain, but they're actually really, really good filmmakers that can do both. And those guys have worked for me for many, many, many years. And we have done those things many times before. So we know what we can do and what we cannot do. Is a trip like this tricky? It is, because anything can happen and you're in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, it was pretty impressive. A lot of the guys we brought along from The Amazing Race, because we knew they could run and shoot, and they are cinematographers. You know, you can't be in every location all the time, so we have to know that they have that incredible eye. But they also have the stamina and the strength to carry, you know, these giant cameras, these 35, 45 pound cameras. We did bring along some additional camera people that, you know, for example, in the first episode, we have this thing called the wall. It's this flat, sheer rock face that we literally put a cameraman that was a climber. So he had, you know, a lot of adventure experience, and he kind of jumart up and down, you know, the mountain, up and down as each contestant would attempt to climb this 300 foot sheer rock wall.
They deserve a medal. The guy on that wall there was fantastic.
And some of our camera guys, they've done Everest. These are the best of the business from around the globe. And we brought them all in and created an incredible team of people.
Generally, I rely very much on cameramen as a rule. So these are my main guys, you know, that I count on to get the story, to get the drama, to get the visuals.
The other thing, in addition to our guys and women, because we had some women out there running camera and sound, we also had these URSA, U-R-S-A Mini Pro G2 cameras. And we also did a lot of drone work, which was really wonderful because we could get these really high shots of, you could see the vast landscape, you could see the shape of the mountains, and you could see these three little people running in the middle of nowhere.
Well, I was going to ask that actually, and speaking to the 20 years you've been doing a show like this, how has technology evolved in ways where you think to yourself, okay, there's no way we could have done this kind of shot even 5 years ago? Is drone technology the main thing driving that for you?
The technology is fantastic. It is just superior to what we can imagine. The drone is a great, great tool. It doesn't do everything for you, but it's a great tool to show where you are, to give it a little distance, give it a little bit of a size of the land, you know, in Siberia, to be able to use a drone and fly around and all this kind of stuff. It's just fantastic. And that you can go over the Mekong River and show things that nobody has ever seen. So there are shots in that nobody physically could never have seen. So yeah, there's a tremendous advantage in that. But also the sensitivity of these cameras, that you can shoot late at night, that is also weather tolerant, because we're dealing with extreme cold, humidity, rain, rainstorms, jungles, snow. I mean, you know, it's all in the show. The technology can take a good beating, that's for sure.
Really, the state-of-the-art cameras with the ultra-high resolution. So, you know, now we're 4K, now we're 8K. The clarity and color in these images that we were bringing home, it just, you know, the world almost looks 3D when you're looking at some of these locations. When we first started shooting in early 2000 on The Amazing Race, we were using Betacams. When I look back, it's so blurry. I don't know how we even watch television like that in the past. But now every little hair or freckle or line, teeny bug, raindrop, it just brings the imagery to life and it's spectacular. And yes, a lot of these packages that we used to work with in the early 2000s were extremely heavy. The really good cameras, what's really heavy are the lenses. But now there's these really compact cameras that have incredible resolution. And like Bert said, in Siberia, you're not going to find a helicopter with a camera hanging off the front. And so the drones that we could transport with them and take with our kits as we're traveling through these routes were indispensable.
Well, that actually brings up my next question, which is the intense pre-production phase of this, mapping out these routes. First of all, who did you employ to help create these journeys?
The way it normally goes is I sit down with Elise, and then what we'll do is, because we, without sounding snobbish, but we know these places very, very well. We know South America like the back of our hands. We know Russia really, really well. Siberia, Canada, we know very well. Southeast Asia, you know, all the places. So what we do is we lay out a route that is identical in terms of water, in terms of land, in terms of boating, in terms of walking, driving, etc., etc. But they all have different climates. Then we send the producer teams out, very often with myself and Elise, and really put the dots together. We do it the second time, and do it the third time, and by the third time, by the fourth time, we actually shoot the show, we already know what's coming.
I mean, the difference between this one and The Amazing Race is that because it is an adventure race and we are doing really extreme activities and sports, climbing, kayaking, all these things, we did hire race directors, people that know safety, rigging, climbing, hiking, everything that we did on the show to verify the routes that we had planned out, make sure it was doable, and find those pathways over the ridges and through the mountains and over the rivers. Where could they sleep outside overnight? Where would it be safe? Where are there no bears here? Is it safe to go through these areas of these countries? Will they find water? Will they find shelter? Can they find food? And where can we get in there if we did need to do an evacuation of some sort?
Wow.
We had an evacuation situation in South America where there's some big riots, and our team got on the way to the airport got into these big riots.
And where in South America was this?
That was in Chile.
And that happened during production?
That happened during production, yeah. They actually literally had to drive through these riots.
And how did you readjust your plans on the fly?
The wonderful thing is that because we scouted it so many times, we knew through our local facilitator, which we've worked with for years and years, and also with Disney Plus and National Geographic through their security team, everybody acted very quickly. They were driving through a part of Chile that things were happening. We got them to a kind of a safe haven location, which was one of our locations they were going to get to. And we had them shut down for about a day until things cleared up. And that got all factored into the fairness of the race and how it all played out in the end. But we were able to get them to safety through everybody working very clearly. And with safety is the key, we were able to get them out of there through the airport, out. And we were towards the very end of the leg, so it actually worked out really well with timing. We were very fortunate. Everyone felt very safe and protected the way we did it. You know, you have these plans set in place before you leave. You hope that you never have to use them, but it is really wonderful when people really do act accordingly and the plan does come together because you've really rehearsed it, talked about it, and planned it.
So to give you the scope of it, you know, so we went all through Southeast Asia from the Chinese border all the way through North Vietnam, Cambodia, down into Thailand, Singapore. And in South America, we started at the very tip of Tierra del Fuego, all the way at the bottom, and made our way all the way up to, initially we were going to go to Peru, but there was just too much, it was too far. So we made it up to Santiago de Chile. And in Canada, in northern North America, we went through Canada from east to west.
Yeah, one end to the next.
And then in Russia, we went from Lake Baikal, we made it all the way through to Vladivostok. So that is also a rough trip, I tell you. you're absolutely in the middle of nowhere. You're thousands of miles away from communication. I mean, some of the only transportation is an armed personnel carrier.
Are both of you present during production on the ground?
I am very, very present. On this one, I could not divide myself in four different places, so I focused on Russia.
Okay.
I was basically at headquarters, which was in our office, and just running these. You know, the thing is that you're running four different shows almost at the same time because of these different crews in different parts of the world. So somebody needed to be at, you know, base camp, which is where I was in LA, and just constantly in communication with everything going on at each location with crews, contestants, driving, you know, it's getting dark, we're having a blizzard. One place was having a rainstorm with flooding, one place was having a blizzard, the other one was having a lot of fog and flights were having a hard time taking off. So we were up, you know, 24 hours a day for the most part.
I was just going to ask, did you sleep at all during this time?
Not a lot. You know, you just have the phone right next to your head. You know, you go to bed, but you're ready to go at any minute.
Elise is the champion. There's no question about it. She is the queen of details. It's unbelievable.
It's incredible.
Very strong.
And I'd love to know, what measures do you take to leave the least amount of environmental impact in each of these locations? Obviously, this is a Nat Geo show. It's a celebration of nature. It's teaching people to preserve their environment. How are you making sure that you're leaving, you know, no footprint, as they say?
You know, the carbon footprint is huge. You know, National Geographic and traveling, you know, global exploration, it represents everything that yellow border stands for. And preserving the world and, you know, leaving it untouched as you left it, as you go through it, but also so important to show how beautiful our world is, reminding people that we have to take care of these places. You know, we did go to glaciers that we could see melting. So what we did with the carbon footprint, you know, we did fly to these locations, we dropped the people in, and then they were really, there was not a lot of flying after they were dropped in, except to go to the final location. But we also did plant many, many trees. We did a whole environmental tree planting to offset the carbon footprint. We made sure we didn't use plastic bottles. We took everything very seriously. Everything we brought in, we took out, and we tried to, no plastic bags. Everything was reusable as much as we possibly could, and nothing was left behind. We respect the globe, respect the earth and all the cultures and the people, and we wanted to be here for thousands and thousands of years more for our children and their children, you know. So I just think this show is a beautiful representation of global travel and adventure and exploration, and just, you know, a mirror of looking back and saying, let's make sure we preserve these pristine locations. And because we did go to some really remote locations that are just epically gorgeous.
Also these nomadic herdsmen in Siberia, if you see how they live, they also clean up after their act, you know. They're also nomadic, obviously, so they travel from point to point before grazing and feeding. So we hooked up with those guys to get us through a difficult area. And how they treat their animals and how they treat the environment is really very impressive.
It's incredible. I'd love to know, what do you think a show like this means to people in 2021, especially after the year we've had, and especially considering that most of us, including myself, I haven't stepped foot into an airport in 16 months? This is sort of this great reminder of this giant world that waits for us.
Giant and small. We have a giant and small world. We can destroy it very quickly, and it's giant if we keep it intact. It's really very valuable. A show like this is very valuable in terms of connecting people and connecting with other peoples and respect. Respect for the environment, respect for other people. And that's always what we're after also as filmmakers. That is, to me, for me, is very, very important. It's a very important element.
Especially during the pandemic, where we have been so disconnected from human contact. Everybody's doing all these video conferences and calls, and you think it's enough, but it's not. We just filmed another show recently, and we did it with all the COVID protections and protocols in place, but it was so really like, I felt like a kid on Christmas morning to see people and actually talk to them face to face. So, you know, people sitting at home that can't travel right now, Bertram and I have not been on a plane in over a year, which is, I've known Bertram for 25 years. We've never not been on a plane every couple of months. It's just not natural for us. To be able to give people a look at the world or a little virtual tour of the world through watching Race to the Center of the Earth, I think it's going to bring a lot of joy to people and a lot of even just hope for, you know, getting back out there again when things get a little better.
It's always like, oh, Russia is bad, and this is bad, this country is bad, that country is bad, these people are bad, that's bad. And we go there, we go all over the globe, nonstop, all the time, and people are wonderful. They just have the same issues you and I have. People are wonderful, people are graceful, they're helpful. I mean, you know, it's almost like there's two parallels. There's the political parallel, where people, they fight all day long from the morning till the evening, that you can see on television. And then there's people like us that go around the world over and over again. I've gone around the world 92 times, and people are always fantastic and super and nice and kind. I cannot tell you how many times people in Russia have given our contestants money or find their passport or help them, or China. I mean, it's spectacular. Do we get involved in political issues? No, we're not. If they tell me you can't go there, I won't go there. It's very simple. I'm in their house. It's not my house.
That's right. We can't judge countries based on governments and politics. That's best left outside of that. Mm-hmm.
Maybe simplistic right. approach, but I think it's a valuable approach. We should have at least one.
I always find it fascinating, especially with people on other shows we've done that travel the globe, where, you know, they'll open up an envelope and it says, make your way to wherever, Vietnam or wherever, China. And people who haven't traveled a lot have a lot of preconceived ideas about some of these places. When you say go to France, one of my favorite, go to Paris. Yes, I want to. But people have thoughts about, you know, however they grew up or the things that were told to them. And then they get there and then they see people welcoming them and smiling and wanting to help. And it's just everyone around the world is just like you and I. You can find somebody you can connect with and have a bond with. And when you have that bond and you smile at each other and just have a nice welcoming face, many times they're going to smile back and you're going to find really wonderful people exist everywhere in the globe, around the globe.
The only people you don't smile at people is in Russia because they think you're crazy when you smile at them.
Yeah, save your smiles, you know, don't use them up too fast, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So finally, you know, if listeners haven't gleaned this fact, you are married. Just in case people didn't know, you are married. And I would love to know, what are the biggest joys and challenges of this partnership? I think after the last year, a lot of us are struggling to come up with new things to talk about with our partners because we've seen a lot of each other. And here you are for more than two decades working together in work and in your personal lives. So tell me, what are the challenges and the joys that make this something that you want to keep doing for as long as you can?
Well, I think it's the timing of when you speak and the rhythm of life. And you have to learn. In the beginning, it's easy. Then there comes a period that it becomes really, really difficult. Now it's easy again.
Is that true, Elise? Does that ring true for you too?
Yeah, you know, we have known each other since 1995. We were married in the year 2000. We have a 12-year-old daughter named Ava. And then this big production company, we have two that produce these enormous shows. There's a lot of stress and a lot of pressure. It's not like we each go to our jobs separate from each other and then we come home and don't really can't talk to each other because they don't know what's going on. We actually bring our work home, which they always say don't.
Right.
We are constantly working and thinking and, you know, we don't always think the same way. We are from different backgrounds. I'm from New York. Bertram is from Holland. There's a little bit of an age difference. We're very different people, but there's some yin and yang of the combination of the two of us. He brings his experience from growing up in Europe, and I bring, you know, the American version of that. And we look at things very differently. And I think together, we really create very unique and exciting shows. And that's a blessing and a curse because there's a lot of push and pull between the two of us. I think we should do this. No, this is better. I know better. No, you know better. There's a lot of drama in our house, our poor daughter who has listened to us all the time. But I think for us, it's a lot of joy. You know, we were home a lot together. We've never sat staring at each other for so long in our entire lives.
Have you run out of things to say or do you still have exciting conversations?
We never run out of things to say. We are constantly on the go. We're already planning our next production. We're already pitching more shows and more ideas. It never gets boring. I remember when we got married, my grandmother said to me after she got to know Bertram really well, you're never going to be bored being married to him. I'm not. There's never a boring day. It's always interesting, whether it's dramatic or happy or sad, whatever we're going through, it is always an adventure with Bertram, and that's why I love him.
Oh, what a lovely note to end on, and I want to wish you congratulations on Race to the Center of the Earth. I can't wait for people to see it. It really is something that we need to just break us out of our stupor, and it's quite an achievement. So congratulations to you both.
Thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Bertram and Elise for joining me today. For more information on Race to the Center of the Earth, please visit natgeotv.com/FYC. I'm Stacey Wilson Hunt, and this has been the making of a Nat Geo podcast. Thank you for listening. The making of a Nat Geo podcast is a National Geographic production. Executive producers, Stephanie Montgomery and Chris Alpert. Host, Stacey Wilson Hunt. Writers and producers, Dave Biesing, Thomas Green, Jason Jackson, Kevin Horton, and Stacey Wilson Hunt. Associate producer, Shanna Blackman. and production coordinator, Juliana Parisi. In association with Bentstown, McVeigh Media, and Sound That Brands.